Welcome to the Pet Industry Podcast, connecting you with the people behind the passion, the leading experts in the pet industry. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Sprinkle. You have a lot of options when it comes to picking a pet food, and you've probably seen a bag of dog food that said grain-free. If you ask 10 different people about their thoughts on grain-free dog food, you will get 10 different opinions, especially after there were news articles about a potential link to grain-free diets and heart failure called dilated cardiomyopathy, or DCM, in dogs. To avoid the I read it on the internet syndrome, which we all fall prey to, we have to look at prospective, controlled, scientific studies. That's what BSM partners and external partners have done. Several papers have been published from a massive amount of research. We have earlier episodes that go into the study design, observing these dogs of different breeds eating different types of diets. So we will link those in the show notes. Today, we'll look at the literal heart of the matter. And this episode is unique in that we are diving into someone health. That's combining human medicine and animal medicine to learn from each other. We wanted to see what we could learn from their research and numerous tools and resources around dilated cardiomyopathy, especially with the study we'll be discussing in this episode with the BSM research team. This research study gave very surprising results that could change how we look at the current tests we run to diagnose and monitor DCM. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if we just had a blood test to tell us everything? Well, looking at whole blood and plasma is the main way veterinarians try to see if certain nutrients that are important for heart health are at appropriate levels. But does that tell us what's happening to the actual heart? Up until now, no one has answered that question for dogs. Currently, veterinary professionals are relying on blood tests to diagnose and monitor what's going on in the heart nutritionally. Yet research by BSM partners showed that there's no correlation between looking at essential heart nutrients like taurine and carnitine in plasma, serum, heart muscle, or skeletal muscle. This means what it says on blood work is not what is going on in the heart or the skeletal muscle. This is a huge finding, as not only are blood tests being used clinically, but they are also being used in research to try to make determinations on heart status. So today we have the BSM research team veterinarian Dr. Brad Quest, board-certified veterinary nutritionist Dr. Renee Streeter, and PhDs and board-certified animal nutritionist Dr. Stephanie Clark and Dr. Sydney McCauley. We also have co-author board-certified veterinary cardiologist Dr. Stacey Leach, and we're bringing in a very special conversation with the human cardiologist Dr. Nitish Chaturi. Since this whole investigation stems from a claim that a particular diet type might cause DCM, we asked the human cardiologist, when he diagnoses DCM, what potential causes does he think about? He didn't mention nutritional causes at all. He said for people, they have two big categories based on if there's a problem with blood flow or not. Then he started listing.
The non-ischemic kind of bucket, that's when we start going down the list of, okay, does the patient have hypertension? Does the patient have hypo or hyperthyroidism? Does the patient have a familial history? You always take a familial history to see if multiple family members have had a similar diagnosis, because there's certain genetic predispositions that might lead to dilated cardiomyopathy, and you might send off for genetic testing if you find that history.
He talked about testing for HIV and even postpartum causes of DCM.
Postpartum cardiomyopathy, sometimes we see that. In fact, there's a young lady in our hospital now. She's a frequent flyer. She comes in with heart failure symptoms all the time, and the cause of her cardiomyopathy, her dilated cardiomyopathy, is postpartum.
That one was a new one for us. The closest we heard him mention diet and causes was diabetes, but that's because there are diet strategies to help with diabetes, not diet is a direct cause of the heart issue. Then we mentioned obesity. Obesity is a big problem in veterinary medicine, as about 60% of our pets are overweight or obese.
I was just reading a paper about obesity-related cardiomyopathy in humans. And in our clinics, we're seeing more and more morbidly obese patients who are coming in with a whole variety of cardiac issues. And cardiomyopathy is one of them. And there is an entity called obesity-related cardiomyopathy, and it does present as a dilated cardiomyopathy.
So if over 50% of dogs are overweight or obese, are we missing some potential risk factors for heart disease? Dr. Nitish reiterated that actually, similarly to veterinary cardiology, a lot of what human cardiologists see is a genetic link to dilated cardiomyopathy.
up to 40% of patients who have a dilated idiopathic cardiomyopathy, up to 40% of them can be found to have a abnormality in a genetic testing. There's a whole panel of different gene abnormalities, up to 25, 30 different genes that have been identified that are associated with dilated cardiomyopathy. And in our clinic, sometimes we do send off the full panel of screening because that can help inform your care, not just for the patient themselves, but also for their family members. Even if they don't have a family history, about up to 20% of them can still have a genetic abnormal genetic screen. So a large percentage of patients who have idiopathic DCM can be found to have a genetic abnormality on the screening. And it can be a big proportion of patients.
If dogs and humans share 84% of the same genome, and we have only identified a fraction of the gene mutations in dogs when it comes to DCM, sounds like there are potentially more to discover.
We found this fascinating. So human cardiologists are not thinking food ingredients when they are diagnosing DCM in people, but are there certain nutritional deficiencies that might go along with DCM in people like we think there might be in dogs? Well, our questions sparked interest, so Dr. Natish had to dive a little bit deeper into the research himself.
I had to do a bit of reading myself because I had no prior experience or exposure to any nutritional cardiomyopathies in our practice. So I had to do some reading to see if any exist out there. And, you know, it seems like there have been some identified nutritional deficiencies that can lead to cardiomyopathy. And there are four that have been identified as far as thiamine deficiency, deficiencies in selenium, which we get in our diet and stuff like that, can lead to dilated cardiomyopathy, vitamin D deficiency and hypocalcemia, low calcium that results from that can lead to heart failure and cardiomyopathy, and I think carnitine deficiency as well. Those are the ones that at least that have been reported that have been associated with dilated cardiomyopathy, and supplementation of those nutrients reverses some of the dysfunction. At least I'm most familiar with thiamine because oftentimes we see patients who are thiamine deficient, especially if oftentimes you see it in people who, you know, are chronically malnourished, whether they're chronic alcohol users and they're malnourished as a result, or if they had a history of gastric bypass or some sort of altered sort of GI anatomy such that they're not absorbing, they present with neurological issues or mental issues, like memory issues as a result of that. And it can also present with heart failure symptoms. We treat that with high dose thiamine and see if they start to improve. From what I looked into, same thing with deficiencies in those other nutrients. Yeah, even in the human world, I mean, there definitely have been identified nutritional deficiencies that can lead to heart failure and cardiomyopathy. And
BSM's literature review on DCM in dogs also discussed other nutrients that can be related to DCM, such as thiamine, copper, potassium, vitamin E, selenium, and choline. They found that there's much more research on these nutrients and the development of heart disease in other animals compared to dogs.
While we don't see very many alcoholic dogs, this does help us understand how important getting the right nutrients is to help the body function appropriately. I'm a veterinary nutritionist. I kind of think nutrition is important. But Dr. Natish then said the big challenge in nutrition.
There's no laboratory testing that can identify, oh, okay, you suspect a patient might be thiamine deficient. Yeah, as far as I know, there isn't any routine, like, measuring thiamine levels in the blood isn't correlated necessarily.
In veterinary medicine and for DCM in dogs, you may have a doctor discuss looking at blood levels of taurine and maybe even carnitine, depending on what they think is causing the heart disease. So let's see what's going on with diet in dogs. Let's talk to the BSM research team. One of the things that people probably read when they were looking at or reading the different news press about different types of food, specifically grain-free or with grains, and dogs developing a certain type of heart disease, dilated cardiomyopathy, they probably also read the term taurine. And so this is a really important nutrient that we may actually look at blood levels for, but I think it's a great place to start with why is this particular nutrient and another nutrient that you looked at that maybe didn't get as much press as taurine, but also carnitine? Like, why is this important? What are their roles in the body of dogs, and especially when it comes to heart health? So, Dr. Streeter, do you mind elaborating a little bit about taurine and carnitine? Not at all. So taurine is a non-essential amino acid for the dog, which means that the dog's body can make taurine from other amino acids. But taurine is really important for helping muscle health. When taurine is low, both skeletal muscle and heart muscle are impacted, meaning they might not contract as appropriately as they otherwise could. And carnitine is another nutrient that is really important in order for muscles to contract. Carnitine carries fatty acids into the inner part of the cell, the mitochondria, to help make energy. So most of the carnitine stores in the body are in heart muscle or skeletal muscle. And then since about 60 to 70% of the energy produced in these muscles is for contraction of the heart, a deficiency in that carnitine, which shuttles the energy source in, can lead to heart dysfunction. So both of these nutrients have been associated with the development of dilated cardiomyopathy, which makes them really important to investigate in these cases.
Great. So for dogs, taurine is an essential nutrient, but considered non-essential in the diet because they can make this amino acid from other amino acids that they can get in their diet. Both taurine and carnitine are important for the heart. So how were these nutrients originally called into question when it comes to the development of DCM in dogs?
I think a lot of it goes back to some of the earlier research publications that had come out on diet-associated DCM. And then it really goes back to some of the meetings that we, the BSM research team, had with the FDA early on in this. In a lot of these research publications, they were looking at clinical cases of dogs with DCM, pulling blood, doing taurine levels, and then kind of making these assumptions in the papers that whether the plasma or the whole blood taurine level came back as either within the normal range or low in some cases, that would equilibrate to levels that were actually in the heart muscle or potentially in the skeletal muscle. We had talked a lot about some of these research papers when we were meeting with the FDA. It was then very intuitive, a board-certified veterinary nutritionist, Dr. Bill Burkholder, who's actually now retired from the FDA, but when he was in his position there, he pointed out very astutely, that doesn't necessarily correlate. What you're measuring in the plasma and the whole blood doesn't necessarily correlate with levels of taurine that would actually be in the cardiac muscle. And, you know, we had some discussions around that, and we actually agreed with him that it would be very valuable in the research community if someone could actually see if levels of taurine in plasma or whole blood would correlate to what's actually in the heart muscle. And the reason this is important, because then clinical practicing veterinarians could use taurine blood levels, whole blood or plasma blood levels, kind of as more of as a guide, as another diagnostic tool. But we wanted to confirm, or not necessarily always, not that we knew we would confirm, we had hypothesized that we thought it would, but we wanted to try to confirm that through this research.
Dr. Schroeder, you had talked about carnitine being important because it helps carry those fatty acids into the mitochondria or the powerhouse of the cell, for those of us who remember being drilled into our heads back in high school biology, as well as taurine and deficiencies of those being problematic for muscle contraction. But when we're looking at deficiencies, are we looking at the blood, at the plasma, the skeletal muscle, the heart muscle? When we're talking about deficiency, where is that in the animal?
Yeah, typically when we're talking about deficiencies, we're talking about a deficiency that we see in the blood, meaning it's like bad enough that we're seeing it in the blood, but we really don't know. It's very possible you could have a deficiency in the blood and still have adequate taurine or carnitine in the heart to perform the various functions. So it's really hard to know. But generally, when people are saying deficient, it's because they've tested the blood. They haven't tested the muscle.
So we're starting to get into what we can look at, especially from a veterinary perspective, and so that we can, one, understand how can we best treat a dog who might be developing dilated cardiomyopathy. And you mentioned a couple of different things when it comes to blood
not to get too complicated, but there's more than just blood. There's whole blood, there's plasma, there's all sorts of ways. So Dr. Leach, what are you seeing as most common when it comes to assessing these really important nutrients and just understanding where a dog's status may be?
Great question there. So when we're looking at the clinical perspective here, the most practical and probably the least invasive way to evaluate most things in the body, including taurine and carnitine, is going to be by measuring their samples or their concentrations in the bloodstream, whether that be from whole blood, which is all of the blood cells and the fluid components, or we actually spin that down and separate it into its individual components, the plasma, which is just a cell-free fluid. But that's often how we measure a lot of biomarkers in the body, is through the bloodstream. It's very easy to get. But however, you guys have already alluded to, the big question is whether or not what's happening in the bloodstream actually correlates with the target organ of interest. And in this situation, we're worried about what's happening at the level of the heart muscle itself. So there's always been some level of debate on whether or not blood markers are actual viable surrogate markers for what's happening at the level of the tissues. With carnitine in particular, I think there is some evidence to suggest that with carnitine deficiencies causing DCM can actually be due to a deficiency in the ability of carnitine to transport into the heart muscle cell. So in that situation, carnitine levels in the plasma would actually be higher than normal because it can't get shuttled into the cell. So there's at least that historical background on maybe why they're not actually correlated, or that they might not go up or down together in equal distributions.
And that's why it's important that in research you have a sufficient number of animals and you observe things over time.
And so it is really exciting to actually be able to look at the tissue samples, as we've been talking about, the direct organ part. We've done skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle as well. And from my experience, taking a sample of the heart tissue is not very commonly done in veterinary practices. Dr. Leach, what is your experience?
Well, yes, there are not many people that actually do this on a clinical patient itself. It is there are minimally invasive techniques for doing this procedure, but it's not something that's going to be readily available to your general practitioner out in private practice. And there's also safety factors to consider, the equipment that's needed, and making sure that the patient can tolerate something like this. It is more commonly done in human medicine, more along the lines of seeing if heart transplants are being accepted by the patient or if they're being rejected as evidence of inflammatory cells within the newly implanted heart. So there are indications for it where it can be helpful, and it's the only way to get that information. But because of the technique itself, it is kind of limited, even in human medicine, but much more so in veterinary medicine.
When we talked to Dr. Natish, he could relate to veterinary cardiology that echocardiograms are the bread and butter of cardiology. And when we asked him about biopsies, Dr. Leach was right.
The use of endobiocardial biopsies, I think, they're not done very commonly. There are certain scenarios where you would do it. And it's usually when you're considering some sort of like infectious or infiltrative process.
So maybe it's a good thing that biopsies don't have to be very common, but soon you'll see why this could also be perplexing when we're trying to understand potential nutrient deficiencies. Coming up next.
I haven't had a dog who needed a cardiac biopsy, but as a doctor and a pet owner, it sounds like it would be relatively expensive, which I am sure can preclude it from being used as a form of diagnostics in veterinary medicine as well.
Absolutely. So we absolutely have to use analgesics and general anesthesia to be able to safely and painlessly collect these. And of course, that's an added cost. General anesthesia definitely isn't cheap. So that does represent an added financial burden to our patients and their owners.
And not all dogs are suitable candidates for this procedure either, due to age or health concerns, since we're potentially talking about dogs with heart disease.
With this being such an uncommon procedure in veterinary medicine, I just want to call out how lucky the study is to have you, Dr. Leach, on board to help with these procedures. This is really impressive that how well you were able to do all of these biopsies on the dogs in the study.
Yes, it was a pleasure working with the team here, and definitely shout out to all the dogs that participated in the study and all of the dogs. They all did great throughout the study and found new homes. So that's always a win. So they had their forever homes.
So Dr. Quest, it seems like based on the lack of information, the assumption was that the whole blood plasma taurine and carnitine can be used to infer the concentrations of those amino acids in the heart muscle. And it sounds like there might be some additional history behind that. You know, what motivated BSM to question the assumption and really dive into researching this to see if it was accurate or not?
I think it goes back to a couple of different things. You know, we had a lot of discussions with veterinary cardiologists, including Dr. Leach. And I should say Dr. Leach is, I would consider, the global expert on performing endomyocardial biopsies in dogs now. But that being said, you know, we consulted with numerous other veterinary cardiologists. We had multiple meetings with the experts at the FDA who was investigating this whole topic. And through those discussions, it came back time after time. And like I said before, Dr. Burkholder had really raised the question to us that if you're measuring these nutrients in the bloodstream, does that correlate with what's actually in the tissue? And it's really a question that nobody could answer. I mean, there was a few studies that had been performed through the years on dogs that they had measured levels of taurine and or carnitine, but they were really small sample sizes. The results were not real conclusive. And a lot of those were clinical cases where maybe everything hadn't been as controlled with as far as what diets the dogs had been eating, had they received other concurrent medications in the study. So what we wanted to try to do was try to control for as many external factors as possible to try to isolate, to actually try to answer or at least add to the knowledge, does the levels of taurine and carnitine that we can measure in the blood correlate to what's actually in the myocardium or in the heart muscle?
That's a good leeway. The whole part of the study to look at the nutrients and the ingredient list. And, you know, ideally it would be nice if something as simple as a blood sample would be able to help tell us exactly what's happening at the level of the heart muscle, or even if a skeletal muscle biopsy, which would be much easier to get than from the heart, if that would correlate with what's happening in the heart muscle. So ideally that would have been great to have found in the study, because that would be much more practical for our everyday general practitioners as we keep looking at this problem here. But there's still a huge knowledge gap in the relationship between taurine and carnitine in the bloodstream and what happens in the tissues. Really, to look at this, we needed to be able to get concentrations from all of those areas at the same time. So doing blood samples and looking at the whole blood and the plasma components, while also simultaneously obtaining samples from the skeletal muscle, which we obtained approximately, I think, 1 gram of skeletal muscle from one of the thigh legs muscles, as well as small samples of heart tissue. That's where we did the endomyocardial biopsies, where the patients were anesthetized. Some of those samples that we collected were evaluated under a microscope or histologically to look for structural changes. And we previously have reported on those findings and found, you know, no differences between the dogs based on the diet types that they're eating. But for this study, we're more interested in looking at the amino acid concentration within those samples of muscle and seeing if those correlate to what we're also measuring in the bloodstream itself.
Wouldn't it be great if there were a blood test for everything? That would make our lives so much better. So I get that at all. And I remember we were talking with Dr. Quest, and he was talking about how tiny the samples were that you were getting from the heart. And they were perfectly viable samples that you could interpret. But that's just how small that you're getting to read off of. I thought that was interesting. And Dr. Quest, you also mentioned earlier, you talked about sample size there briefly, and I'm going to put on my nerd hat for a second, if I haven't already, and because I think this is a really important part to talk about just research in general, and that is really knowing the proper sample size that you need for your research, because one, you want to make sure you have the right number of, in this case, dogs that you can actually interpret the data that you collect. So it's meaningful. But at the same time, you don't want to enroll more dogs than are necessary.
And you did a power analysis, which we'll go into in a future episode. This is to date the largest study that's been conducted in this area of VetMed. But you did a lot of work to come to the number of dogs to be used in the study. And I know, Dr. McCauley, you did a lot of groundwork in this to determine how many dogs that were going to be needed to be statistically significant. So would anyone like to kind of explain a little bit about the importance of this and kind of what the work was going into deciding how many dogs were going to be for the study?
Yeah, and part of that about this power analysis, it determined about 64 dogs. We had 65 in our study, and that's, again, like you had mentioned, that's quite a bit of dogs, and we had to utilize research dogs to be able to control for a lot of factors that were going on in this study. But doing so, we wanted to make sure that these research dogs were well cared for and actually above and beyond the normal research standards. So for back in my day at Mayo Clinic in the Caring Canines program, we had a dog trainer come in and actually work with the dogs, train the dogs using positive reinforcement. And she really got to know the dogs and understand them and work with them to make them very adoptable. You know, not every dog is happy-go-lucky. Just like humans, some of us are shy. Some of us are really extroverts and outgoing. And the same was for our dogs. So we really relied on her. And I'm really excited about this upcoming episode where we get to dive a little bit deeper into that. Because since all of this, she's opened up her own training facility, boarding facility, where she can actually take animals that are fostered or needing to be adopted and do the exact same thing that she did in our study.
I love that part of this. And before we get into what we've been setting up, which is the results of what you found on do the blood and the muscles all correlate, I think it is important to focus in on that word correlation. Maybe out there have been some people hear the term correlation, not causation.
As you said, correlation does not equal causation. It's one of my favorite phrases that we always throw around. I like it because, you know, just because something looks like it may be a cause doesn't always mean that it is.
I always loved the little cartoon that was trying to describe correlation versus causation. And the picture was, as more people were eating ice cream, the rates of sunburn went up. But if you look at the graph, it might look like eating ice cream gives you a sunburn. But in reality, it's people eat more ice cream in the summer. And that's usually when the sun is out. And so they're getting sunburn from the sun. So it's just kind of a fun example of the definition of correlation versus causation, if you are interested in some nerdy memes out there. And I liked your visual image, too, of the graph. So as we're going to look at whole blood and plasma and skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. So I'm curious, what did you find? What were some of the things that you found most interesting?
Yeah, this is the question before the question, right? We wanted to see if these things were related, the blood, the skeletal muscle, and the heart, so that we can understand what we're even measuring. So that was what this was. And what we found with it was there was no strong correlation between plasma, whole blood, skeletal muscle, and cardiac muscle, taurine or carnitine concentrations.
I would have to agree with Dr. Streeter's conclusion there that sadly, it unfortunately doesn't look like measuring these amino acids in the bloodstream is an accurate assessment of what's happening at the tissue level. And also that even skeletal muscle doesn't necessarily reflect the same things that could be happening at the cardiac muscle levels. Sadly, I don't believe that those are going to be reliable ways to know what's happening with the heart, especially when we're looking at evaluating for nutritional deficiencies causing or associated with heart disease. This has also been looked at by some other researchers recently, some other colleagues here at the University of Missouri. I can't remember. But they also recently found some discrepancies or lack of correlation between taurine levels in the bloodstream and in skeletal muscle in a recent paper that was published in Frontiers as well.
That's interesting that they're finding similar things.
Dr. Leach, with this other paper being published, what do you think is going to happen next? If you had a crystal ball, could predict the future. No, just kidding.
Depends on who's funding the research projects. Sadly, in clinical practice, I was always trained to measure taurine levels when you're concerned about a nutritional deficiency. There's always been some question about whether carnitine in the bloodstream was actually a reliable marker of what's in the heart muscle. And the few times I had actual clinical cases where I was concerned about that, I was unable to find any lab that would actually run carnitine levels anymore. As far as moving forward in the future, I think we can rest assured that measuring blood levels is not going to be helpful in further looking at this disease process or in clinical patients. Sadly, I think we have to know what's at the level of the tissue, and whether or not that's going to happen on a research project or in patients.
Dr. Sprinkle and I had the opportunity to talk with a human cardiologist, and we asked them if they look at taurine and carnitine in the blood, and they're like, no, not really. And they're like, you guys do that? We're like, yeah.
It's also really expensive. I think for our clinical patients, we would have to charge, I think, $200-$300 for a plasma taurine level. And that just gets you plasma. And the recommendations were to do both. So you got to spend another $200-$300 to do whole blood. What most of my clients do is, why spend the money? Let's just supplement extra taurine just in case. It's cheap, pretty free of side effects, and saves them $500-$600 and dollars.
I think we've known that being able to fully understand and how to measure nutrients has always been a challenge. I think that's a thing about the specialty, me being a nutritionist. Sometimes it is just really hard to measure and understand. One, because the body is pretty cool. It likes to keep things in a very narrow range in the blood. And so it's really hard to know.
This particular research found that blood tests are not a reliable indicator for nutrient levels in the heart. Dr. Quest, you've seen and participated in a lot of research in the pet food industry. How do these results relate to previous results? And in your experience, how has this information been used clinically? And will this kind of maybe throw a wrench into the research realm around DCM?
There's an old saying that all good research leads to more research. And I think what this does is it casts a light on some of the previous publications, you know, and some of the inferences, and in that some of these diets may cause low taurine and or carnitine, but a lot of those were based on clinical cases. And I think Dr. Leach mentioned it earlier. It's a lot different doing research on animals. I mean, animals that you know has DCM, and then looking at some of the things that we looked at, as opposed to controlled research where we had healthy animals and we were actually trying to see if we could detect any differences in the dogs eating the different diets, where in this case, what we're talking about in this podcast is whether or not taurine and carnitine correlate to what we can measure in the blood, to what we can measure in tissues. That probably emphasizes the importance of controlled research as to try to create guidelines or answer questions that we have in veterinary medicine and veterinary nutrition, as opposed to necessarily using clinical case research.
And Dr. Clark had mentioned that we had been able to speak to the human cardiologist, Dr. Natish. And it was really interesting to see the parallels of looking at heart disease. So for example, an echocardiogram is their bread and butter for diagnosing a dilated cardiomyopathy in a person. So I'm like, oh yeah, that's exactly right. That's what we do to figure out, oh yes, you know, this patient has DCM. But there were some differences when it came to the different tests that they may run. They do not typically look at taurine or carnitine status. One of the neat things about Dr. Natish was his passion for what we call One Health. So in my mind, that it's like how we learn from each other, both in human medicine as well as in veterinary medicine. And so probably as you were doing this research, Dr. Leach, you've probably spoken to some cardiologists for people looking at the differences of human medicine and then veterinary medicine when it comes to, you know, dilated cardiomyopathy and the ways they diagnose but treat and everything like that.
Yes, I think there's definitely been a big push, at least in the medical industry, for this One Health sort of driven research and clinical medicine, because a lot of what we see in veterinary medicine mirrors what they see in human medicine and vice versa. Now, there are some differences with human medicine, at least human cardiology. I would say nutritionally mediated heart disease has always been at the forefront of what they deal with. Mainly in the form of arteriosclerosis, coronary artery disease, that kind of thing, heart attacks, whereas it has only more recently been at the forefront of veterinary cardiology with this concern of diet-associated DCM. But there are some parallels between heart disease in general. We both see genetic or heritable causes of DCM, which has led to research in both fields. So one of the research projects I'm most passionate about is looking at genetics of DCM in standard schnauzers. And we found the gene mutation for that disease process because just a year or two beforehand, gene mutation in that same gene was identified in people. Had they not made that groundbreaking discovery of a gene that was associated with DCM that had never been thought about before, we probably wouldn't have looked at that either and found that discovery ourselves in at least a dog model of DCM. So I think there are lots that we can both learn from each other.
I think you may have a giant schnauzer. Am I correct?
I have a standard schnauzer. I got two of them. Yeah. Now I have two of them. Might be working on a third down the road.
And then Dr. Streeter and Dr. Clark, well, and Dr. Quest, we're all in a veterinary medicine field as well. So just your perspective as well when it comes to incorporating a One Health approach here.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of scientific investigation, a lot of times animal models are used as the starting point for human medicine. But in so many cases, since more resources, financial resources, really, and the larger populations that are involved in human studies, they get to the good information first. And then, like Dr. Leach was saying, oh, let's check that in dogs now. Let's check that in cats now and see if we can also either treat or prevent a disease or even surgical procedures from procedures that are utilized in human medicine. So it definitely goes both ways. And I think the One Health approach is just so crucial for veterinarians and human doctors to work together, not only for things like this, you know, medical things, genetic things, nutritional things, but infectious for sure, right? It definitely goes both ways. And I think more and more we're beginning to learn from each other. So key takeaways, right? We can't, unfortunately, use blood measurements and skeletal muscle measurements to understand concentrations of taurine or carnitine in the heart muscle. We also now know where taurine and carnitine concentrations in healthy dogs are. So before we had reports, but now we have 65 healthy dogs where we were able to measure their heart muscle concentrations and their skeletal muscle concentrations. So we can now use that information to help guide what normal is in these healthy dogs. So as always, these things are exciting. They're going to help us understand the future. But every dog is an individual. If you are a pet parent who thinks your dog may have a heart condition or has DCM, you know, you have to seek out a cardiologist and a nutritionist and work with them to find what's right for your pet.
So while it may be a little confusing that this study showed no correlation, and there has been some past studies that looked at these levels or took plasma or whole blood samples and looked at both of them or individually amongst a group of dogs, this is part of research. We're constantly learning and we're constantly growing and we're adding to the knowledge that we have. So it's important to read up-to-date research. And like Dr. Leach had mentioned, there are more studies that are looking at correlation in the tissues, in the whole blood, in plasma. And so as we continue to learn more and more, it's important to stay abreast of it and to see how these research studies can impact and will impact veterinary medicine. And, you know, going back to the One Health approach, seeing how human medicine is changing, even with AI, with our conversation with the human cardiologist, how that will begin to impact veterinary medicine as well.
So what's next? Well, we know that nutrition is still important for our pets. Even our human cardiologist said that diet can be a cornerstone to treatment for people with heart disease.
I mean, the cornerstone of like cardiovascular health is diet and nutrition. I mean, that's something I always prioritize, at least my patients, to always make sure that I give them my two cents on what a heart healthy diet might be, lean meats and unsaturated fats from essentially the Mediterranean diet, green leafy vegetables, lean meats and unsaturated fats, olive oil as well. Like all those things have been shown to be heart healthy. Whole grain, lentils, legumes, that falls into that category of healthy sources of carbohydrates and fats. You know, overall balanced diet such as that, you know, exercise too is also really important to preventing cardiovascular disease. And so the American College of Cardiology, AHA as well, they recommend routine, regular aerobic exercise, you know.
And some exciting things are coming. So eat well, get some exercise, and subscribe to the podcast. Thank you for joining us on the Pet Industry Podcast, a BSM Partners production. If you want to learn more about BSM Partners, please visit us at bsmpartners.net. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast and share it with a friend. We want to thank our podcast team, Dr. Sydney McCauley, Corrine Harris, Ada Thomas, Michael Johnson, Dr. Stephanie Clark, and Leanne Haggerty, and our amazing editor, Cliff Dubinois.